Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace. So today we're going to start a new section of the picture archives, and for that first we're going to use the drag and drop blocks on the archive front page. You can see I just hit a plus and that automatically allows me to insert a button. Everything's great, no broken formatting or anything. And this is going to be the Lieutenant Commander Brian Dutton archive, kindly hosted with his family's permission. Now I'm going to put an unlisted page, and as you can see, I'm going to use the gallery section, which comes pre-done with a title and a section of pictures. Then I can just very easily link to that page. I've called it Belfast. And just to check, yep, clicks, goes through. Very easily changing the titling in the text box up there. These unlisted pages, of course, won't appear on SEO searches, so you can easily choose what you want Google to find. Then switch out the default pictures with the actual pictures that have been provided. And then with the easy to use interface, I can choose how many pictures I want to show, what ratio they're going to be shown in, how far apart they're going to be spaced, all sorts of other things. Very easily configurable, applies instantly to the entire gallery block. But as you can see, as soon as I click on one, you get the full picture at full res. So all very nice and easily done with Squarespace. So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenefell. You can get a free trial, and once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show. Hello everybody. At the beginning of the year, in January of 2026, as some of you may already know, I hosted a naval history conference aboard HMS Belfast. And, well, since this is the modern digital age, and, well, this channel is, surprisingly, mostly online, I thought rather than publishing a papers or proceedings of said conference in paper form and expecting everybody to buy physical dead tree copies, although theoretically I could make some of those available if you want, instead, I thought, let's publish all of the conference presentations online. So once per month, starting with this month, I'll be publishing one of the presentations, starting, of course, with the first one, working way through as if you were there during that particular day. There are obviously a few caveats, because, of course, if I'm going to publish them online, why would you come to the conference? Each of the speakers, generally speaking, had a Q&A afterwards. I won't be including that Q&A, because I know the speakers are fine with me putting this online, but obviously individual people may or may not be happy with that. Also, obviously, if people are asking questions, audio pickups and stuff, a little bit more difficult. But anyway, the main point is you get the main presentation, and I will be using the slides from the presenter's PowerPoints to provide you with images as they are speaking. So with that said, enjoy Professor Andrew Lambert making the first presentation of the conference.
Our fashion changes, now something new. Distance, we'll start to see what they're forward. So why iron bolts? In 1871, the first Lord of the Admiralty, George Joachim Joshen MP, who happens to also be the chairman of Lloyd's of London and a director of the Bank of England and a major City of London financier, was speaking at the Royal Academy dinner. This is the dinner that follows the Royal Academy annual show. Those days had just moved to the current location of the Royal Academy, previously in Somerset House. And he said this to the assembled artists of England, quote, "I will ask the academicians here present that if this year they have painted, and I quote, the wooden walls of old England, they will paint next year, if their genius be equal to it, the iron bolts, which are as necessary to our security as were the wooden walls. They are the types of science and strength." So basically, the head of the Navy was telling the British artistic community that all this meandering backwards into nostalgia was utterly useless. It had not created something which was iconographically useful. The Navy needed a representation of power. The Art Journal was a bit sniffy about Goshen's speech and begged to differ. It offered the alarming prognosis that linking the passing of wooden walls would mean the end of British domination of marine art and, by extension, of naval supremacy. So if we stop painting the past, we will lose our present and future glory. I think Goshen gets the better of that intellectually. He was a very smart man. He was First Lord of the Admiralty in the 1890s as well, having crossed the floor of the House of Commons, which is something that we're watching happening on a daily basis today. He ended up as a very eminent Conservative Member of Parliament, having been Liberal. Interestingly, however, the picture I'm showing at the moment was created by, Edward William Cook, who was a major artist in the field of painting nostalgic views of wooden sailing ships. But Cook accepted the challenge, and in 1873 at the Academy, he exhibited this, HMS Devastation firing a royal salute. He'd made quite a lot of money painting wooden walls and coastal views, but he was ready for the challenge. And Cook was intimately familiar with the modern industrial world. Many of his customers, people who actually had the money to buy these big wall-hanging pieces, were leading industrialists. And his client roster included Cyrus Field and Sir John Pender, who were the giants of global telecommunications in the day. These were the men who laid and operated global telegraph cables. They liked pictures of ships, funnily enough, including cable-laying ships. Pender, in particular, is one of the unsung and unnoticed giants of the Victorian era. By 1901, his company owned pretty much the entire world's global cable network. The cable network that his company laid, the cables were made on the Greenwich Peninsula under what is now the O2 Arena, and they were essential to winning two world wars. Cook attended the Royal Fleet Review on 23rd June 1873, which was staged to celebrate the arrival of Nadir Shah, the ruler of Persia. And while there, he sketched the ships, including Devastation, Agincourt, Hercules, Sultan, from the deck of Thomas Brassey's yacht. Thomas Brassey, major industrialist. His son was also an MP and a junior Admiralty Minister later on in his career. So that synergy between art, political power, technology is very real. The search for a new language of naval power is underway. This is not how old ships were represented. This is a new kind of image. It's about translating the science of ironclad warfare into something you can use to impress or, if necessary, deter potential foes. How do you convey power in an age without masts and sails? How do you celebrate new kinds of artillery? So Cook chooses to feature Devastation, the first modern battleship, low freeboard, four heavy guns in two turrets, and massively thick armor, no masts, no sails, and painted a rather grim kind of color. The ship dominates the image. It's firing its forward guns to starboard as a salute to the royalty presence. That's British and Persian. The stump mast shift the visual emphasis from height to width. This is now a low, flat subject. It is not a very tall subject with a great spread of canvas. The barge in the left foreground provides scale and some sense of human activity. Important, I think, to see that. But the small piece with the small boat between the barge and the Devastation is a torpedo launch. They're bringing in some underwater weapons as well. Cultural criticism comes this time from the art expert John Ruskin, who thought it somewhat sable and lugubrious as a spectacle. But of course, Ruskin was the great advocate of the work of J.M.W. Turner, who had painted in a different era and in a different genre. His reference point is Turner's great Trafalgar picture, which is not a representation of reality, it's a purely allegorical work. Brassey bought the picture, that is Cook's picture, and it was presented to the newly established Royal Naval College at Greenwich in the mid-1870s, by which it descended down to the collection of the National Maritime Museum, where it is owned today. I'm not sure whether it's on display at the moment. It's certainly available online for your pleasure. The fleet review and the image had long been critical elements in the representation of naval power as deterrent. They defined the emblematic nature of British power. The process of changing from wooden three-deckers, latterly with steam power, to the so-called pre-dreadnought battle fleet, usually examined as a technology question, an iconographic question as well. You need to be able to present this as power. It's not a technological curiosity. It has to work. It has to say, this is real and it's very dangerous and you don't want to mess with us. It's a study of art and culture. How do you capture and present a new kind of power in an age of almost constant change, at a time when Britain is not going to be fighting a single fleet battle of any consequence between Trafalgar and Jutland? So everything changes, everything stays the same. You have to find a new language to deal with this problem. Both the formal fleet review process and the iconographic work that goes with it is intended to emphasize stability and security. These are meant to be pictures of power that make the British feel secure. Everybody else realize why it feels. It's about dealing with challenges to the stability of the European order and of extra-European problems as well, which may involve the Russians. So the British are very much a status quo power. They want to maintain what they have. They want freedom to operate beyond Europe. They want Europe to be stable, peaceful, and certainly they don't want the French anywhere near Belgium, which is a very large theme. Before 1860, the British fleets were displayed moving. The Great Fleet Reviews involved ships at Spithead carrying out complex evolutions to display not just the ships, but also the quality of the people on board them. The ship as a system, not as a static, but as a moving. And that's why Cook has the ship firing. It's in action. There are men on board the ship. You can see things happening. And this is very much a feature of previous fleet reviews. In 1856, at the end of the Crimean War, the Royal Navy conducts its biggest ever exercise, and it's its first ever major steam-powered Royal Review. Queen reviews the fleet between Portsmouth and the Isle of Wight, and it includes nearly 200 steam gunboats purpose-built to bombard St. Petersburg. This was a clear statement of intent, and it was issued on St. George's Day, the 23rd of April, 1856, and invited guests included the entire diplomatic corps from London, who were advised that the British were still masters of the universe. The American ambassador refused to attend on the grounds that he didn't wish to be deterred in public. Yep. Ships also work by carrying names. They represent power also through words. So Imperial and especially Republican France uses a collection of names which make you think that radical change is coming. You're going to have to fight quite hard to prevent it. The British go for a more static and secure element. So as your countries change, they change the nature of the iconography of their ships, also lexicography. Now, the Russians have a lot of saints on their battleships because the war they're most interested in is a religious war with the Turks to capture Istanbul. But all of those ships named after saints are in the Black Sea fleet because that's the fleet that's going to attack Istanbul. But the fleet in the Baltic has a different set of names and talks about different things. It includes a battleship named after one they took from the Swedes, just in case you don't know where they're going. So deterrence in the mid-late 19th century depends on both sides recognizing power and using display to convey it. So the Russian equivalent of a British fleet review is not a Russian fleet review. That would be a pathetically weak signal. It would be a Russian army review. If you've ever been to St. Petersburg, you will know it is a very large display place for armies. The grand open spaces are designed for the assembly of very large forces of troops. How did Tsar Alexander celebrate his victory in the Napoleonic Wars in 1814 in Paris? He conducted a manoeuvre by 120,000 troops on the Champ de Mars, under the Eiffel Tower these days. He said, look at me, I'm the master of the universe. The British government immediately ordered a fleet review at Spithead. They invited the Tsar to come along, and after 2 days of manoeuvres, he was thoroughly seasick and completely and utterly deterred. He then came to London and was very badly behaved while he was there. On the way down the river to return to Russia, the ship stopped at Woolwich Dockyard, where he was invited to watch the launch of the world's largest battleship, HMS Nelson. Suitably deterred, the Russians weren't much problem after that. So it does work. Russians never thought they could take the British on. Between 1860 and the late 1880s, there's a great deal of incoherence about where ships are going, how designs work, but eventually it does start to settle down. Before we settle down, we need to remember just how these things were done. This is Charles I, sovereign of the seas, first great three-deck battleship. It was designed and built as a display item. The gilding cost more than a second-rate battleship. The ship itself cost a fortune because it used outsized timbers and all of its cannon are bronze. It's not intended to fight, it's intended to say, I am the master of the seas, and there is a political offensive that goes with this. This whole question of whether you can rule the seas or whether the seas are free, the argument between Hugo Grotius, Dutch saying, well, the seas are all free, and James I and then Charles I saying, no, the seas are ours and we control them and we can tax this. And the allegorical design on the Sovereign of the Seas, later renamed Royal Sovereign, is all about that boast. I am the King of England and I rule the seas and I will tax you for using them. Dispute my authority. I have 100 brass guns on board. Not built to fight. When it was used in battle, it turns out it was very effective. These big three-deck ships were enormously powerful. The Dutch referred to it as the Golden Devil. And it was rebuilt. And of course, Royal Sovereign is the second flagship at the Battle of Trafalgar. When Turner does battleships, he does them with a full allegorical flourish. There were no men struggling in the water at Trafalgar because only a lunatic would get off a wooden ship. Wooden ships don't sink. Iron ones do. Those men in the foreground are referencing the nature of the battle. And the man right dead center, upside down, staring out of the picture, is a quotation from a picture of Napoleon at the Battle of Eylau, which Turner had seen move. This was painted in 1824. And it hung opposite Philippe-Jacques de Lutherbourg's great picture of the glorious 1st of June in the entrance chamber to the royal audience room, James's Palace. This picture says, I'm the King of England. We have the world's biggest navy. Probably better behave yourself. A lot of naval officers didn't like Turner's picture because it is fundamentally inaccurate. The foremast never came down. The Redoutable didn't sink. And the Spanish flagship didn't catch fire either. This is allegorical. It is not literal. Most pictures of ships are literal. Turner is big enough to get away with this. When you're up close with this picture, it is enormous. It is on display at Greenwich. Because George IV was fed up with naval officers complaining about it, so he gave it to the National Gallery of Naval Art in 1828. Recognize a bit of plagiarism going on here? This is the French flagship, Le Breton, at the Grand Review in Cherbourg, inaugurating the French naval base that was meant to deter the British from fighting the French in this period. What is happening here is that Queen Victoria and Prince Albert are on the royal barge. They are going alongside where they are greeted by Louis Napoleon III, who essentially is saying, look at my enormous naval base and my excellent squadron of ships. You'd probably better do a deal with me. Albert then has to explain to Louis that the British don't do that kind of deal. They're not going to redraw the boundaries of European states to suit the French, and they're not going to agree to any changes at all, in fact. And this conversation is held in German, because both Louis and Albert are first language German speakers. Louis Napoleon grew up in German speaking Swiss. At this point, the whole jamboree collapses because it's meant to be an event where Britain and France get together to order Europe. The British decide they don't want this. And the iconography is perfect because this is Le Breton. It's the only French steam-powered three-deck battleship. And it's the one time it gets displayed, used, complete and utter failure. The British are not impressed. They've got a flagship just on the other side of the harbour, which is just as big, just as powerful, and it's called Prince Albert. Or Royal Albert, in fact. So warships give different messages, and French are trying to issue a very British kind of message, and it doesn't work. Louis Napoleon is trying to impress the British, but the British are not impressed because they know the language that he talking, and it's not one that they're prepared to entertain from them. The British have a larger fleet, and the public was committed to the maintenance of naval dominance. It's not difficult for the British to use this event to turn the balance of power against the French. The main result of this was the creation of the National Rifle Volunteer Movement, which mobilized nearly 1 million adult men who bought their own rifles and their own uniforms and stood ready to defend the country. This made an invasion of England utterly impossible and restored the balance of power to its natural structure. Within a little more than a decade, the French Second Empire had destroyed in battle by the Germans, and France was not much trouble for many years after that. But Louis Napoleon did have one more attempt to assert French naval dominance. The French had the first ironclad capital ship at sea, La Gloire. And here we see a new iconography. This ship is not spreading much square sail canvas. The sails there are fore and aft. They're mostly to keep the ship steady. This is a wooden-hulled, iron-armored warship. It doesn't have any of the bling or luster of the previous generation. Where's the figurehead? So all of that iconographic material, which had been so important, the decorations, stylings, way the hull is painted, just a black ship with a black funnel and some white sails. All of a sudden, everything has changed. This is industrial naval power. And that's the problem that Goschen is identifying and that Cook is trying to deal with. How do we industrialize naval power? By contrast, the British build HMS Warrior, which is ship that looks like it belongs in the previous age, but in fact technologically far more advanced than Gloire. It has an iron hull, it is primarily a steamship, and it is designed for a new set of armament, including rifle breech loading weapons. Warrior would have been finished with a frigate strake along the gun deck to make it look even more out of date, but fortunately they didn't do that. Warrior fails to set a new aesthetic in the way that Gloire perhaps had because it is too close to the old ships. It looks like a bigger version of the last generation of wooden steam-powered frigates for the very good reason that that's exactly what it is. They took the design of the previous big frigates, HMS Orlando, and they simply just stretched it out and put some armor plate on it and built it out of iron. So iconographically, this is an old ship. Technologically, it's a very advanced ship. It's a, what a subtle thing. Gloire is technologically backward. Warrior is progressive, but iconographically, it's way around. What does that tell us? British are being cautious. They have a lot to lose in this iconographic battle. The French are being aggressive because they don't have much to lose. They haven't been winning those naval wars. They don't have prestige to lose. So they're taking a chance. Very quickly, the British realize that having this old-fashioned design doesn't work. Warrior is an iconic vessel, but it's an iconic vessel with a problem. And what you notice is the third ship of that class, HMS Achilles, does not have a bowsprit, does not have a stern gallery design like this. All of a sudden, they've borrowed the design from Gloire. It's built straight around the stern, and they've chopped off the bow and got rid of the bowsprit. They've picked up those design cues that the French have issued and said, yeah, we can do that. Achilles doesn't have three masts, which is normal. It has four. One way of boasting. And after that, you get the three Minotaur-class ships, each of which has five masts. So why are masts important? Well, important. The Minotaurs are interesting because the last ship of the class is called HMS Northumberland. And on the Admiralty docket, it said this ship to be named Northumberland in memory of the ship that carried the Emperor Napoleon to Spina. Yeah. The French were smart enough to know what the British were saying. Her sister ship was Agincourt, a name which we're not allowed to use anymore, apparently. So Warrior changes the technology, but it doesn't change the iconographic approach, but it does ultimately provide a new approach. And then, of course, we get what the Americans are doing in their Civil War. Of course, these aren't ships. These are just floating fighting platforms of very dubious seaworthiness. The Merrimack was too shallow to go up the river, and the Monitor would be destroyed in a storm. These are a different kind of ship. Very simple, very small, relatively so, barely seaworthy. They are not icons of sea control. They are icons of something else. They say, we can put a lot of firepower in the coastal area. So these are not fighting a fleet battle for command of the sea. They're fighting about access to the James River, Confederate capital of Richmond. And it's draw. Neither side wins this battle. The Confederates are able to hold the river, but then the Union Army seizes the naval base at Norfolk. They're forced to evacuate up the river, and they actually sink the Merrimack themselves because they can't move it further up the river. So these things are hideous iron boxes on top of rafts. Talk about an age lacking in grace or elegance. But they also have an impact in Britain. So many on the liberal left are convinced that pirate ships are the future, and this is going to lead to another major problem. When the iconographics take over from basic engineering. Liberal leader Richard Cobden, the man who believed in free trade and supported the American Union administration in the American Civil War, was a powerful supporter of the turret project of Captain Cowper Coles, Royal Navy. Because Coles offered new technology as an economy measure. Does it sound familiar? Politician keen on economically attractive benefits. But there's very little fighting between ships in organized formations. The only significant naval battle of this period is the Battle of Lissa in 1867 between the Austrian and Italian navies. And they've got plenty of ironclads, plenty of big guns. And the only thing that really matters is that the Austrian flagship rammed the Italian flagship and sank it. So they went back to the Battle of Salamis for tactics, and it worked really well. These things look a bit like Gloire because they're essentially the same technology and pretty much the same kind of system. And the reason the Austrians win is because their admiral's got some good ideas, and the Italian admiral isn't actually on his flagship, and nobody in the rest of the fleet knows where he is. So command and control is lost, and a shell disables the rudder of the Italian flagship, leaving it at the mercy of the relatively slow-moving Austrian flagship. These are wooden hulls, and they're very weak. So when they're rammed, they sink pretty quickly. The way ahead, of course, is to build ships of iron, and here is HMS Captain. Now, this is a very well-constructed visual. A captain is meant to look like power. It is designed to exude something which the previous generation, the Warriors and even the Achilles and the Agincourts, have not quite managed. If you look, it's got a great deal of symmetry. It looks like it was designed by a five-year-old. Lots of very straight lines. The rigging is held up by tripod supports to get rid of a lot of that rope rigging, which was used on earlier ships. And this is going to be a problem. So the ship is designed by Cowper Coles, who is not a naval architect. He's a monomaniac, an obsession about turrets. He was successful in the Crimean War, developing inshore power projection assets. And in a chance, he comes up with an armored box to put the gun in. And he's talking about patenting this when he talks to Mr. Brunel. And Brunel says, why don't you put a railway timetable under that? So these turrets are literally railway turntables with an armored box on the top. That's the patent. Coles is persuaded, and the liberal elite is persuaded by Coles, that this is the future. Two very big guns, 12-inch in each turret, thick armor, freeboard of less than 6 foot. Could have been higher, but they sort of overbuilt it. The tripod masts mean that the rigging is enormously strong and will not be broken in a gale, unlike standard wooden rigging, which would not stand up to that. If he'd taken the rigging off, the ship would have worked quite well because it would have removed a lot of high-up weight, and it would have removed what actually destroyed it, which was all of this top hamper being caught by the wind. Its lack of stability was largely because of its low freeboard, and once it was rolled over just past the level of stability, the water poured in and it went down very quickly. With almost entire crew, including Captain Coles, fortunately, perhaps didn't survive. So, in pursuit of a new iconographic language, you created a disaster. At the same time, the naval architects at the Admiralty designed a ship to the same specification called HMS Monarch, which was in the fleet on that night and was not troubled by the weather at all. So, this is about the pursuit of image at the expense of practicality. It did have the useful advantage of ending opportunities for monomaniacs to interfere with major and important processes. So Cook's image of 1873 does not come entirely innocent. It comes on the back of full understanding of the Captain Disaster. After the Captain Disaster, the First Lord of the Admiralty had a nervous breakdown and was replaced by George Joachim Goschen. So when Goschen is talking about his iron bolts, talking about something which is really very controversial, it's not, oh, we're just moving in this way, we should sort of think about this. We just had a catastrophe out there. We've had this whole iconographic issue revealed, the big problem. Nobody's going to paint the Captain. I dare you to paint something that looks a bit like the Captain without masts on, which is essentially what Devastation is. Same armament, same basic systems. Really interesting. So the real point of all of this, as I've stressed before, is not to compete with other people's navies, because other people's navies aren't competing. It's to compete with other people's other symbols of power, armies, splendid architecture, such and such. 1870, 71, we get Franco-Prussian War. All of a sudden, the French Navy disappears. Don't need to show off anymore. There's nobody to impress. The French are not a threat. The only threat the French pose is not so much iconographic as textual. They start to rename their ships after Republican heroes because they've now got a republic again. So the Empire stuff goes away, and now it's French republicanism and quite a lot of Napoleon. So they're talking a good talk, but their navy is not really up to the job just at the moment. 1878, this isn't a great picture. It does capture the different kinds of ship that are available. So you've got turret ships, you've got broadside masted ships as well. This is for a spat with the Russians over the future of Istanbul. So the Russians are massing their army and marching down through Bulgaria, and the British are mobilizing their fleet and making sure the Russians know this, because the fleet is going to go where to stop the Russians? Going into the Baltic. The chief of staff of this fleet is a very interesting officer called Fisher, Jackie Fisher. You may have heard of him. Fisher's approach to war is based on deterrence. It's based on an understanding of what the enemy's susceptibilities are and how you press all of the necessary buttons to make them do what you want them to do. So 1878, Royal Review, that's the Queen's yacht coming down the middle. Look what we've got. It's not a hugely impressive fleet, but compared to the Russian Navy, it's really quite something. The Russians in this period have, in the Baltic, 10 or 12 coast defense small vessels, one battleship. The British can send their entire fleet into the Baltic, and they would make very short work of Kronstadt and St. Peter. We now get to a new iconography. This is HMS Dreadnought, the half-sister of the Devastation. You will see two very big slab-sided funnels, 12.5-inch guns paired forward and aft in turrets, and the white element on the bow is the breakwater that goes up when they're at sea, because it does have a bit of a water issue. This is in Malta Harbour, and the ship behind is one of the Indian Army troop ships. This is what British power looks like. Mediterranean under British control, the conduit for British power through to Asia. Couldn't be more obvious. So there's a fleet in Malta, the British control, the global position, and this ship starts to give you what you're going to need. Black hull, yellow funnels, white upper works. This is going to be the colour scheme right the way down to the early 20th century. Shortly after this, new ship turns up, HMS Inflexible. Our first captain, Jackie Fisher again. This one has four 16-inch guns, muzzle loaders, in an on echelon bastion between the funnels. The masts are not for sailing. It's not a very good design unless you understand what it's designed to do. It's not designed to fight other ships, because there isn't an enemy out there to fight. It's designed to fire all four guns directly ahead at a fort. So the on echelon arrangement of the turrets means that you're firing on either side of this very narrow set of upper works. They tried it and it wrecked the upper works. But it was used at the bombardment of Alexandria in 1882, where it performed fairly well. It was also one of the first battleships with electrical systems on board. That didn't work, because by the late 1880s, other navies are building battleships. So we go back to a ship designed for fighting in linear structures in a line ahead battle with your main fire on the broadside. So Collingwood, four 12-inch guns in open barbettes forward and astern of superstructure. Key thing to notice, two big slab-sided funnels. This is starting to become a British style icon. This is what British battleships look like. They need to have two big funnels. It's not about getting smoke out of the boiler room. It's about having the right look. The R-class battleships, or Royal Sovereign class battleships, the 1890s, they had their funnels side by side because of contemporary boiler design. They would have had them fore and aft, but contemporary boilers condemned them to have funnels side by side, and it doesn't work anywhere near as well. But at least the British are now building 10 or a dozen ships of the same class, and they're identifiable as such. So Empress of India is one of nine ships, all the same. All the others have R-class names. But they needed a ship for Queen Victoria, so they gave her one, Empress of India, just before HMS Victoria sank. The French were doing their own thing, which they always do. They were issuing specifications to their dockyards and allowing the dockyard engineers to build their own ships. So Magenta is one of a class of four, which don't look alike at all, but they are basically the same ship, but they just iconographically look very, very different. The French like their heavy guns spread around the ship rather more literally, and they like these very strange looking fire control towers. They're not very good ships. The Great Harbor at Brest, Neptune is another ship of the same class. Doesn't look like it is, but it is. They're not tactically really good squadron mates either. The French also got into the habit of building very, very, very large armoured cruisers and naming quite a few of them after historians, because historians were important to creating the radical republican agenda of the contemporary period. One is Edgar Quinet, who's a politician. Six funnels. Are they boasting? Yes. Not all of them are necessary. Again, this is a style issue. The British never really went beyond four funnels. That was plenty, but the French had to go two further. And there was an iconographic point in that. I have more funnels than... Apparently in the Middle East, four or more funnels makes you look really good. So some British cruisers actually rigged up fake funnels. One four-funnel cruiser got another one with some smoke in it for status, because the Russian ship on station did have five funnels. So in such pathetic things, the judgments happened to be made. So the French armoured cruiser was a very peculiar vessel, enormously expensive, burning huge amounts of coal with a massive crew, and its job was to chase merchant ships, almost all of which were small and almost entirely worthless. So this is a very large, prestigious symbol of a failed strategy. Attacking British commerce with vessels like this would be ultimately futile. As we know, in the 20th century, you need a small, agile, mass-produced attack system to take down that large ocean-going commerce. This was not going to do the job. But it had to be big, because under international law, if you sank the ship, you had to take the passengers and crew on board. You can't do that with a U-boat, can you? Armoured cruisers excited the city of London, which brings George Joachim Joachim back in, because he's now First Lord of the Admiralty again, and the British are going to start building some big armoured cruisers. And their response includes powerful and Drake-class vessels with four funnels. They're very impressive, very expensive. But iconographically, they're very important, because they show that whatever the French can do, the British can do it better. And they have their own new approach. Naval Review at Spithead. This is the Diamond Jubilee Review, June 1897. I put the artist's name up in lights because Eduardo Di Martino is one of the rare men of genius in this field. Born in Italy, southern Italy, a Neapolitan naval officer, he left the sea as a service to become the artist of Italian and then Brazilian naval power. This is why his picture of Spithead looks like the Bay of Naples or Rio de Janeiro, rather than reality. The vessel in the foreground you all know is Cervinia, yeah. So he's giving you the highlights, but he's also giving you this very long run of ships, which are essentially the same. So we've got R-class battleships, we've got Majestic-class battleships, we've got some of the follow-on battleships. And the big British ship on this side is one of the Powerfuls. So this is the biggest warship in the world, Powerful, 14,500 tons. Very impressive piece of engineering, utterly useless, because the French ships that were in chase are never going to be much of a problem. Again, usual Queen's Royal Yacht moving down there, but Turbinia is a bit of a disruptor and hints at what's going to happen next. Di Martino worked for the Emperor of Brazil, Pedro II, very interesting figure who created a maritime identity for Brazil, only to find that the Brazilian army didn't want to be maritime. They arrested him, deported him, and declared a republic, the first five leaders of which were all Republican generals. He then came to England and worked for Queen Victoria, and she notes in her diary that Mr. Martino had brought the picture all the way up to Balmoral for her to inspect. It's a big picture. So Victoria understands this. She's hiring the best artists, not just British, also. DiMartino spent the rest of his life in Britain. Formidable, they're able to put the funnels in the proper order now because they've got new boilers. So this is a formidable class battleship. And now we start to see what all of this adds up to. There's a majestic class battleship with a formidable behind it. We're right off Copenhagen. The spots on the picture are on the lens of the camera. And this is Admiral Arthur Wilson's Channel Squadron, 9th of September 1905. The British have just deterred the Germans from declaring war on France by sending the Channel Fleet into the Baltic without being invited. In fact, without notifying the Germans at all. The Germans understand this and they back down very, very quickly. So the whole purpose of all of this stuff I've been talking about is summed up by this picture. Why isn't there a war in 1905? Because the Royal Navy is far too powerful for the Germans to take it on. The end of this era is the King Edward VII class of almost semi-dreadnoughts with a couple of 9.2-inch guns on each broadside. They're not adding anything particularly interesting to the discussion. They just look like slightly bigger versions of the previous class. Something new has to happen. Here are the King Edwards in serried rank for the Fleet Review of 1902. Again, they're fine, and there are lots of them, but we need something new. And here we have the Coronation Review, and yes, that is a French cruiser with five funnels. There's the Lord Nelson, which is semi-dreadnought with 10 9.2-inch guns as well as the 12-inch guns. But again, that isn't good enough. It doesn't do the job. We need something new, and it's Dreadnought. Dreadnought is a new image. It's conscious style icon, which happens also to be a revolutionary piece of technology. And this picture is perfect because it says here is the old iconography, here is the new iconography. And when you get half-decent artists, they can give you something really impressive. Here is Alma Cull's picture of the first squadron of dreadnoughts proceeding at speed. There's something about this, the way that he's got the light, the way that the ships are in motion, the way that they almost seem to be bending into the sea as they move forward. Really impressive piece of work. And it sums up what the dreadnought arms race is all about. Concentration of power, relatively small number of very large, powerful ships. Kell's work is interesting, not only for its quality, but also, sadly, because almost all of it was destroyed in the Second World War by a bombing raid. This one is in the Maritime Museum collection, Greenwich. Then the British start to improve. So this is HMS Tiger, the first ship to be heavily influenced by Eustace Tennyson Dyncourt as chief naval constructor. The organization of the mast and the funnels is almost perfect. This is a very conscious piece of design, as you will always understand when you look at the Japanese half-sister, the Kongo, which is not anywhere near as elegant. It's just the same ship, but it doesn't work iconographically because the Japanese insisted on changing the way that the funnels fitted together, or indeed they didn't. The funnels are not consistent, coherent on the Congo. So ships built essentially the same design, but iconographically very different. Queen Elizabeth, 1914, what's the standout? Two big slab-sided funnels. And what is Fisher doing? He's playing with ever bigger symbols. So here is his revolutionary idea for a massive battleship with 20-inch guns. And he's starting to reduce the superstructure down. We're going down to one funnel. He's moving away from the slightly cluttered dreadnought model. This is then realized in the renowned Repulse design, brought to a culmination with the Hood design, two slab-sided funnels, lots of power. Of course, Hood was never meant to be a long-lasting icon. It was meant to be updated by later and more impressive ships. But that doesn't happen for international legal reasons. If you compare Hood with the American battleship California, you will see the difference between something that's been designed and something that's been thrown together. California is a very powerful ship, but it's hideous. It makes no attempt to be elegant. When the French do something hideous, it's stylishly hideous. It's just as hideous. Everything about it is solid, practical, and it's as good a fighting ship as you can get on that displacement, but it just doesn't work. Nobody's going to be bothered by this. And it doesn't look like it's going to do the business. By contrast, when the British are planning their post-First World War capital ships, the G3 design, two big slab-sided funnels, purpose is served by this. So the G3 would have captured the essence of the Dreadnought era and the earlier Dreadnought era of the Ironclads and projected that forward. Instead, it was left to Hood. Hood is the icon of British naval power all the way through the interwar period, not because it's the most powerful ship in the fleet, because it isn't, but because it's the one that has the right style cues. Instead, the most powerful ships are ships like Nelson and Rodney, which are very strong and maximize, rather like the Americans, but I think Nelson and Rodney are far handsomer than California. It just doesn't work. And you can see that in this crossing picture where Nelson and Rodney and Hood are crossing paths. You can't make Nelson and Rodney beautiful. You just can't. And so the ultimate expression of British power is a very flawed piece of engineering, but it is unbelievably beautiful. It's hard to imagine that the man who designed this also designed the tank. Very much.